I'm Marilyn McCarney. Betsy Payette and I are interviewing personnel who were or are instrumental in developing Renfrew and Museum and Park. Today is April 23, 1992, and Will Shepherd, one of the youngest members of the current staff, is being interviewed. Will, a graduate of the College of William and Mary, has been doing archaeological research for Renfrew for the past couple of years. Wait, I'll get it. And I will...
Oh, okay. Let's see. I came to Renfrew Museum and Park in, would have been June of 1987, as an intern from the College of William and Mary, basically working on my master's degree from William and Mary in anthropology, studying American culture. And so we came to Pennsylvania to study Pennsylvania Germans. I felt excited about that at the time because my family is Pennsylvania German heritage, and I had relatives living in the Shenandoah Valley in the 1750s, so it would be real interesting to see how these people had grown up and lived. Got involved basically because James Smith, the curator, had also been a graduate of William and Mary, so it naturally made a tie-in to where to look for students. And started with the tannery excavations. We spent the 6 months working in the picnic grounds looking for the remains of the Royer Tannery, which was built roughly 1795, operated till April 1862. Spent the first summer not finding much of anything, which is usual in archaeology, takes a long time, but we did uncover enough pieces of the old tannery to come back in 1988, came back that following summer, and have been with Renfrew ever since, working on that site. At the tannery, we located the original shop that was built in 1795, located a large part of the operation itself. There still is a great deal of information that could be found down in the picnic grounds some future date, including a mill that was down there as well for grinding tree bark into powder. Since then, we decided that it only seemed logical to work on the next industrial site to better understand how the Royers here had worked on the farmstead, and we worked on the mill site in 1989. In that interlude between the fall of 1988 and starting on the mill in the summer of 1989, we also did work on a outbuilding survey in Washington Township. And as part of that was to gain better information on restoring the smokehouse and the milk house, and finding out what kind of contemporary buildings would have been in the area, how they would have been constructed, and how best that we could interpret those buildings. And we looked at about 100 surviving outbuildings just in the township. Let's see. What else? Excavating the mill site turned out to be quite a wonderful project, since it was full of about 17 feet of fill dumped into it. As typical, it was the foundation seemed to have been knocked in. Our best information on it were garnered from tax records, a little bit of information we could get from deeds, but actually local informants turned out to be of great help. Whitey Menick could tell us a lot about remembering the building abandoned, playing around it as a kid, shooting off 22s inside the walls, listened to them ricochet, and we did find 22 casings inside it. But two other persons also remembered the building. A woman, I cannot remember her name now, I've got it in my notes somewhere, had played around the property as a child and could remember, she thought it was a house because it was a large abandoned brick building. So she could remember that, and the best information came from Bob Walters, who was a local farmer on the adjacent property, Strickler property, who now lives in Wayne Heights, who could remember, he wasn't sure of the dates, but he thought the mill had been knocked down in the late 30s after Bell Strickler had passed away by a, I can't think of his name yet. Got it in my notes, Joseph. I'll have to look that up. But it was knocked down by a gentleman who lived in Wayne Heights to get the stonework to build 116 Landis Avenue over in Wayne Heights, the only stone building in Wayne Heights, and it's stone from the mill site. And that would explain why in sections of the mill we're missing probably 6 or 7 feet of wall that would originally been there and was knocked out. Explains why when we dug out the mill, we found the roof across the basement floor with the wooden supports and the shingles. Then we found all the brickwork and all the mortar piled in on top of that, and then a little bit of limestone on top, so that, you know, the mill was inverted into the hole. But that would explain why they knocked it down and where the stone went. Because at first we were trying to imagine how the stonework had been originally laid out, and it didn't make any sense because we didn't seem to have enough of it considering the size of the building and the height of the bank. It seemed very unusual. And then once he came along and told us, well, some of it probably was stolen away, that made sense. let's see, what else? The fun part, but the difficult part of trying to use local informants is because the memory is always selective. You've got to try to pick and choose, and it helps the Whitey that we were out 2 or 3 times talking to him about it, because once we found parts of the foundation, were able to expose it, say, well, there looks like a room here, then he could give us a much more information where windows were and that sort of thing, the more information you can give them. So that worked out well. The other problem was the Brick Miller House, which was a little brick house built probably about 1855 that sits across the trail from the mill, was probably bulldozed in 1943, and it was also pushed into the hole. So we had a second house, and then in 1970, sometime in the 70s, a brick building burned downtown next to Frank's Pizza, behind Frank's Pizza, or maybe it was the office building next to the bank. Right in that block there, the Sherman building, when it burned down, the bricks from there were also brought and dumped down in the mill site because it was a good place to get rid of them. So there was quite a lot to uncover. Unfortunately, with the mill, we didn't find a lot of information on the earliest workings of the mill because it had been radically changed in the 1880s. About 1885, they came in and gutted the building and turned it into a creamery. Probably one of the earliest sanitary creameries around here. The only reason it was a sanitary creamery because it had a cement floor and a drain that you could clean it out. And in 1885, that made it sanitary. Easily to clean. But we don't know much about the creamery, how long it lasted or anything. I haven't found any records for it yet. But we do know it comes from A.J. Fonstock. He left a letter in 1909 describing the property he had written to Harry Strickler to tell him information on it. And then once I started doing research in newspapers, found that in the 1880s and 1890s, A.J. had a lot to do with the running of the property. He's listed on a couple of different advertisements. In 1879, he tries to sell the mill, which turned out to be the same description that we got in the letter. And then we also found records with the families. With his father and his aunt passing away in 1883. And then that happened to be the same time that we also came across Eliza Coffey, who also passed away on the property in 1883. And A.J. was administrator for him. And the only other record we have for Eliza Coffey is that he was a freed slave in 1826 when Abraham Stoner, A.J. Fonstock's great-grandfather, passed away, which was the law of Pennsylvania by then, that slaves should be set free when they reached a certain age after 1800. Looks like it's going along. Okay, let's see, what else? So we spent all of 1989 working real hard on the mill site. What was I going to say? Some of the other things we did find out was that Peter and Nancy Fonstock did not inherit the rear part of the property, the back farmstead, until the death of Catherine Royer, the daughter, Catherine, not Daniel's wife, but Daniel's daughter, Catherine. She passed away in November 1883. Peter and Nancy Fonstock finally inherit the back part of the property, which is kind of unusual since they've been paying taxes on that property since 1858. And that Nancy and Peter actually owned the front house. They bought it from the estate of David Royer in 1860 and probably lived in the front stone house most of their life. And we're still not sure for certain who lived in the back part of the property. The Bonebrake family, we believe, lived in the property at least at one point when they rented the property. rented the mill. And it was probably a tenant family living back there, possibly even Catherine. Catherine Royer, living back there as well. So it was, we still have a lot to do to try to track down just who has been on the property and where they've lived. Okay, well, after we completed the mill site, we worked on several other projects. The latest series of work that came last year, we were working on, we did excavations on the privy site behind the main house. That was quite found by accident. Walking through the rear yard last spring and found that a 4-foot hole had appeared in the yard due to the frost heaving in the ground and settling, and also because a coffee bean tree that had been taken out the year before was probably beginning to, its root system was collapsing. So that we had a large hole, and rather than just fill it in, we decided to do a little testing, and sure enough, we found some stonework, and it turned out to be an 8-foot deep privy shaft. Stone lined the entire 8 feet depth of it, and which is really unusual for a privy shaft. We have not yet determined why they put that much energy into doing, which is basically an outhouse, basically a pit. Most of our research, at least what I know of privies, usually it's just a hole dug in the yard and then a wooden frame put over top of it, use it for a while, and if you get done with it, then you just cover over the hole and you move it, and you can, so that, and a lot of times when you find privies in a yard, you'll find a series of holes around a local area. In this case, we didn't, and we actually found a second privy, stone-lined, sitting next to it, and it's possibly that they had it set up as almost like a septic system, was moving from one building to the other, moving the foundation back and forth and covering the one for a time period. The other information we have on that is that down towards the base, there were deliberate spaces left in each of the four walls at the levels near the bottom, as if they were designing it as a septic tank to let the material drain out. Seems very sort of ingenious, but also seems it tells us a lot about what we're trying to understand, the Pennsylvania Germans, that they felt real organized about the world. Any chaos in the world was a bad thing. It would be sin. It would be evil. And so they were trying to redefine their environment. Now, we knew that with the retaining walls around the Fahnestock house. We knew that with the landscaping of the property and the work they'd done. But to go as far as even making sure your privy was proper, seems that it was a real strong part of their lifestyle. And hopefully we'll find out more information. We can do some more research on other privies or maybe dig a few more. Oh well. And the second one in the yard, the smaller one, has not been completely excavated. Sometime we'll probably come back and redo it. We decided to leave it where it was and always know that we can then come back. It will at least have the same kind of information and material that we found in the first one. Because we did get deep enough to start finding the grape seeds, and we literally found millions of grape seeds in both of the pits. It seemed to be quite a lot of the food processing got dumped into the pit as well. The privy would not have just been the outhouse, but it also was the depository for leftover kitchen scraps and material, and they were probably squeezing out the seeds and dumping the resin in. They were fox grapes, which are still found on the property, which are a native species that the Royers would have been utilizing because they were very sweet and needed very little pectin to set into jelly. So they were probably the best grape they could get at the time, and fox grapes, I've been told, were then cultivated to become Concord grapes. So they were definitely trying to utilize their environment the best. We located 28 plant species that the Royers were using on the property. It's hard to tell in the privy shaft. What we tried to do in archaeology is separate out the different soil colors and layers and then date the artifacts we find in each layer and then get an idea of the age of the sequence. And in the privy, unfortunately, there was a lot of mixture, probably because they were dumping. Also, they were possibly taking material out of there periodically and putting it on the fields for fertilizer too. But from the amount of artifacts that we found, I'm not sure if they were really doing much of that, if it wasn't more of a settling pit. And we found literally probably, 10,000 artifacts in the hole, mostly ceramic glassware. We found human, well, can't say, I'm assuming it's human hair. We found pig's hair. We found leather, we found pieces of shoes, Some of the other interesting things found: a pistol, a little boot pistol made out of copper. We found a doll. We found, let's see what kind of material. We got down towards the bottom. We were finding pieces of bone comb. I was going to say, I had something on the tip of my tongue I was going to say. Can't think of it now. Oh well, we did find just an incredible amount of material from their daily lives, which will give us a much better understanding of what the warriors had here and what kind of material they were utilizing. Down towards the base, we did find almost a complete spatterware dish, which is very ornate down at the very bottom layer. We're hoping it dates, it could have possibly dated to the early construction of the privy. Probably doesn't. Probably dates to sometime around the mid-1820s, 1830s, before Daniel Royer passed away. But most of the material in the privy probably dates to the 1850s or right around 1860 when David passed away. That was probably the largest time period of the material in it. So it still gives us a pretty good indication of what was on the property a century ago. But the privy looks as though it was probably utilized all the way up until possibly the 1940s. I know it wasn't capped off, at least one of those two shafts wasn't capped off until 1943. And we're not sure how long the Beaver family and the Mannix, Whitey could remember privy being about that same location. And we also have a map done by Dennis Good in 1943 for the Nicodemus family that depicts a privy in that spot.
I heard you say something at one of your meetings about if you are digging and you come to lime, then stay away from it.
Stay away from it. Yeah, that's in a burial. Yeah, if we find it in a burial. In the privy, we found some lime, and I wasn't too worried about that because they were dumping it in periodically sanitary. But if you put it on a burial, it usually means that it's an infectious disease, particularly cholera. And so you would try to avoid that, digging any deeper if you came across that. On a grave, and that could be important if we end up doing any work up at the cemetery. Right now, there wouldn't be any real strong reason to do excavations at the Burns Cemetery other than to determine how many more graves are up there, because I'm certain there's a lot more graves that have markers. The markers are only the ones that the Burns family had preserved, particularly in the 1920s. And there were earlier stones up there. There were field stones that a few people have photographs of that were marking graves up there at one time, too. And it's interesting to note that the Royers, who are buried over at the Mack Cemetery over in Wayne Heights, that there are two stones in there that are field stones propped up without any kind of markers on it either. And so it was, I guess, an early process of just marking the graves any way you could. It probably would have had a piece of limestone stuck in the ground to mark the grave and then a wooden marker supporting that. And so the stone was sort of more permanent and you could replace the wooden one. And eventually no one comes along and replaces the wooden ones anymore. And then since most people don't realize it, then they take out the stones and plow over top of it. And so, but it would be interesting, I guess, at one point just to see how many graves are up there, and not necessarily dig out the graves, but take off enough of the topsoil that you could identify where graves were located. The problem with that is I also found a record by C.W. Kramer, who was a local historian in the 20s, 19-teens, I guess he passed away in 1915, but he accounts in a story of Waynesboro how they were doing diggings when the Stricklers were here up in that cemetery looking for the Renfrew sisters. And so they did not find any evidence, but it could be a lot of disturbance up there. And I think a lot of the tombstones were probably lost when that was going on, about 1910. So it's a shame. But it's always those little pieces you try to piece together to puzzle it out and to try to reconstruct the history here. Well, from the privy, we also worked on the lime kiln, which wasn't a real exciting insight, but we felt it was important to take out the fill that was inside of it, about 6 feet fill, to expose the interior of it and get ready for possible restoration of that building as well, because the kiln was a very important part of the farmstead. It provided the raw material they needed for just about every activity they did on the farm. The lime was used at the tannery to take hair off the hides and to also clean the hides before they went to the actual tanning process. Lime was used at the mill. They had a plaster stone there, at least in the 1870s, where they were grinding the lime up into plaster and selling that. And then lime was used as the mortar and the set and the whitewash for all of the buildings on the property at one time or another. And then they would have also probably used some of the lime on the fields as a fertilizer and also help keep down the pests. So it was utilized in just about every aspect of life. They would have utilized it, and it would have been something they could also have sold. I'm sure they were selling it off, at least locally, and probably transporting it. And they're not the only ones in this area to have had a lime kiln on the property. There are quite a few in the area. At least in the about 1870, there would have been 15 in the township operating, and that's because of the topography of the land, that the limestone is exposed on this part of the county. And so we've got a lot larger concentration of lime kilns because it was much easier to get the lime. The other areas that have a large concentration of lime kilns, there were about 90, 95 that operated in the county, were along, basically about along the Interstate 81 corridor, which follows the natural break in the valley between the limestone and the shale land. And that was another part where it was easily utilized, and also the shale land is where they really needed to use the lime. It was much more prevalent use because you've already got limestone soils here. There's a lot greater demand for it, and so the kilns were closer, so they weren't shipping it that far. But it was quite an industry in the valley up until the 1920s, producing lime and shipping it out of this region. It's one of the things with doing research on the property to find out just how geared towards manufacture and shipping that this county really was early on, even in the 1780s, 1790s, that really built up, one, on the agricultural base. It was such a good place to farm, but also shipping goods, wood, lumber, shipping the raw material, the iron industry very early on. Also then utilizing, Waynesboro actually developed as a wagon making center in the 1820s. And then that led to later building agricultural machinery out of here. And then the valley itself also produced raw goods material. We had over, at one point, there were probably close to 300 mills, half of those being sawmills, but operating in the valley as well. It was quite an area for growth and development. So we taking a look at the way the Royers fit into that. And one of the interesting things is looking at the Pennsylvania-German pattern, as we see it, that they were reinvesting their goods and services. The whole or basis for the thesis I worked on for my master's thesis was that the Pennsylvania-Germans would live separately from the way their English and Scots-Irish neighbors. Now, they had a separate language that they could utilize when they were at home. They had separate customs, some separate dress, but one of the basic patterns that we were looking at was the fact, the way they handled finance, and the fact that this farmstead was generating a great amount of income. Daniel Royer was a very wealthy member of this society. At the same time, he was not investing that in his household. He had very simple, very inexpensive furniture, didn't spend a lot of his money. Less than 7% of his total worth was tied up in just his household belongings, where some of his neighbors who had a little bit less income were spending 25 to 30% of their basic money on household goods, fancy furniture, silver services, tea services, things that would tell people that they were financially successful, that they had status. And while the German members of the community had just as much income, they would not to go to that same pattern. And we also see it in the way that the Germans, I think, in some ways tended to reinvest in the family, building industries on a farmstead that family members could take over. Then much of the money that was developed here at Renfrew went to Blair County, where they also did an iron industry, the Royer family. His son, Samuel, worked in the iron industry up there. Supposedly that in 1838, when Daniel died, a third interest in that operation up there was worth $22,000, which is quite a tidy sum for 1838. So they did seem to try to reinvest in the family and keep it growing. At the same time, in town, doing research down there, we see that much of that money was also spent not on the family, but in land speculation, house building, and you can really see that the same people that Daniel Royer spent his time with were using their money in a different way, and it really shows different patterns and how they did see the world as being somewhat different, even living in the same community. Just kind of neat. Okay, well, we got off the track. Let's see, I was talking about the lime kiln, which wasn't too much to talk about, and the last work that we've been doing, which we still are doing a little bit of work, is at the Fonstock House. We've been doing excavations at the back part of the property, getting an idea of hopefully the age of it. We're assuming it's earlier than the front stone house because of its construction. It's very Germanic in its design, with a kitchen, a vaulted cellar. Well, not a, it doesn't have a vaulted cellar, but with a kitchen built into a bank, and then the house built above it with just two rooms on each floor. Very typical of the German plan house. Probably had an entrance at one of the gabled ends instead of on the side that it has now. That one's been moved. When they added the brick part about 1855, they did a lot of renovations. Most of the terraces and the landscaping we now know probably were put on the property starting in the 1840s, but a lot closer to the construction of the brick part of the house and not with the early stone part. When the stone house sat out there by itself, it really was sort of isolated on that hillside, just sticking up out of the bank. And then with the mill down below and then the farm above it. We did testing on the terraces looking for outbuildings, which we were not real successful. We didn't find too many outbuildings around the brick part of the house. We did find what is probably a bake, not a bake oven, a smokehouse, a smaller brick foundation on the edge of one of the terraces with a lot of ash. But the brickwork is very small and is not the kind of heavy masonry you would need to support a bake oven. But it would probably have supported a small smokehouse that would have looked contemporary, being brick with the brick part of the house. It was on the terrace. We also found that at one time there were brick walkways from the house to the different outbuildings and around the terraces. So one time that whole real part of the property was probably really landscaped during the Victorian time period. We found a brick drain on another terrace that we have absolutely no idea what it was used for. It's a very odd feature that will eventually need more research. It's three bricks deep and basically a brick wide, and so it gives you about a 1 foot deep and about a 6 inch wide air channel through the center of it. And we're not really sure what they would have been utilizing that brick drain for. It has at least one brick that's stamped Harrisburg, so it also tells us that it's later, it came after the retaining walls, or at least at the time of the retaining walls, and probably even a little bit later. It dates to about the 1870s. It's real unusual that it also is going against the lay of the land. It is actually higher, lower, how to describe this? The hillside is sloped down to the terrace, and the drain is higher at the base, and is actually running against the lay of the land, against the slope, down into the hillside, as if they had something low that they were actually gathering on the side of the hill in the bank. And so eventually we hope to do some work in there and see exactly where this drain is leading to or where it came from. The other real unusual part of it is that the clay around it is bright red because it's been heated. Extreme amount of heat was generated at one point around the exterior of this this drain, and it's approximately 7 inches on either side of the drain, and it is deep as the drain is, so it's over a foot deep, just this pocket of red clay on either side of it. And I'm not sure what kind of operation would generate that kind of heat in such a limited space, or if it has anything to do with the drain at all. Maybe somehow this clay was brought in and dumped, but it was burnt. You know, it's almost as if you would expect it to have been manufacturing bricks or something on the property, but the drain itself doesn't have those kind of bricks utilized in it. So it's really weird. Very weird. So one of those questions we'll probably have to do more research on before we can get any kind of answer for. The other work we've done around the Fosdock house was just trying to find a builder's trench and also uncovering part of the spring house. There was a spring house down below the Fosdock house. It is roughly 8 feet long, well, 8 feet wide and about 12 feet long. It is a little bit smaller than the front milk house, but not by a whole lot. So it was a pretty substantial structure down there at one time. It was later modified because of the slope of the wall pushing in. They later subdivided it to put in another support wall, and that part of that was partially filled in. And when Ed Miller came to the property, all he remembers is the one half of it opened up without any kind of covering on it. It just a spring covering. But I think at one time it probably was a more substantial structure. It just slowly disintegrated. The spring water runs out of it, flows out of it today very well. It's a good running spring. The material we found inside of it dates to a lot of different time periods because a lot of trash that was dumped in. But I think some of the earliest stuff that we found eroded into it, it probably dates to about the time of the house. It's the same kind of ceramic that we would expect for the 1810s, 1820 time period, which we think it dates to. We think this brick part of the house probably dates to about 1808. It's our best guess. It was probably built right after the mill in 1806, 1807, and before the main house was erected. We did find some evidence around the exterior of it for some ceramics and some oyster shell and some stuff that was dumped in probably during the construction or right afterwards, which would date it to about 1810. And that is what we've done so far on the excavations. Okay, doing research at the library, did find some sale advertisements for the property in 1890. The sale of the front house and about 50 acres. When it sold, it was referred to as the Antietam Farm in those records. Then when, Dr. Strickler passed away in 1911, this farm was then referred to as the Glen Willow Farm, and it's also in some of the other records in town. It's referred to in Needs Book, his 1900 rendition of Waynesboro as also being the Glen Willow Farm of Dr. Strickler.